Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
That's right, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here once again. This month, May 2017, is very, very interesting because, among other things, JFK would have turned 100 this month. President Kennedy's birthday was 529, May 29th, 1917, and it's unlikely he would have lived to 100 as a natural sort of cause of things, because especially because of all the medications he was taking. But it's a very important anniversary, and we're going to be you're going to hear a lot about it in a lot of media. But the best media is sitting right across from me. That's Professor Nash from Penn State, your favorite buzzkiller, and he's here to help us talk about the early life of JFK and certainly the state of the field. How are you, Professor?
Doing great. And
are you going
to
make
happy to be declared the best media? Thank you very much.
Are you going to make it to 100?
Oh, I doubt it. But yeah, you're right. He definitely would not have made it to 100. I'm pretty secure in saying that.
Okay. But what are we going to talk about today that the buzzkillers really need to know?
Today, I'm just going to sort of give the state of the field, I guess, in terms of what we understand now about the actual history of the man and the presidency, selectively, right? We're going to hit certain sort of high points,
right.
Certain interesting, what I think are interesting topics. There's no way we can tell the whole story.
No.
That would take many, many, many podcasts, but...
an own podcast of its own. You know,
absolutely.
The JFK podcast.
Yes. We're just going to hit some of the high points, but hopefully bring people up to speed. There's no prior knowledge required here. We'll hopefully do enough introductions so people know what's going on.
Well, what's interesting you say about prior knowledge, we were chatting before the show, getting ready for the show. You said something very interesting about his birth date anniversary versus his death date anniversary.
Right. Most people, even people way too young to remember, know November 22nd, 1963, mm-hmm. right? And even in terms of anniversaries and publications, we'll talk about this later, we always mark the death date. With people like Washington and Lincoln, well, Lincoln was assassinated too, and so there's a
But we have Washington's
little,
birthday.
Right, exactly.
We tend to, when we
mark famous people, MLK, right? We mark birth dates. In JFK's case, because the assassination was such a big deal and such a major event, we mark the death date, which I think itself tells you a lot about his place in history.
And so very few people know that he was born on...
Yeah, May 29th. I mean, that's the kind of thing most people would have to look up.
1917.
Yeah, exactly. How many people even know his birth year?
Yeah.
A lot of people know he was a young president. Not the youngest, by the way. That goes to Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, right. The youngest ever elected is it?
Correct. Right, youngest ever elected. He was 43 when he was elected.
But when you say someone's born in 1917, I think my grandparents were born in 1917. Right. But of course, my grandparents were JFK's age. And
although,
we forget that because he's frozen in time.
Right. Although, of course, you know, the whole new frontier and the passing of the torch, that whole trope that he relied so heavily on because he was the first president born in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, of course, drawing a big contrast between himself and his significantly older predecessor, Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, just for a little fun to begin with, we want to play you a clip from one of his birthday parties and a certain very, very famous actress, very, very famous platinum blonde actress who sang him a song. It's very, very, it's also very well known out there, probably more known than his actual birthday.
Oh, yes.
But both the song, the way it's presented, and JFK's response is fascinating.
In Madison Square Garden, by the way.
Probably the only place big enough to hold the people who wanted to go.
It's where I have all my birthdays. Yeah, I don't know about you.
Absolutely. So here we go, Buzzkillers. Take a listen to this clip.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. President, happy birthday to you.
Everybody, happy birthday.
I can now retire from politics after having had Happy Birthday sung to me in such a sweet and wholesome way.
Well, there you have it. This is a wholesome show, and that was certainly a wholesome presentation of a presidential birthday party.
We do nothing but wholesome here.
Well, let's start then, since we're talking about his birth date, and let's talk and way back in 1917. Let's talk about his early life.
Right. Well, he's part of the now famous Kennedy clan. His yes. father was Joseph P. Kennedy. His mother, Rose Kennedy, from the Fitzgerald clan. These are both, it's interesting, both sides of the family had sort of very solid backgrounds in Boston Irish politics, mm-hmm. Irish Boston politics. One, I think the, let's see, Honey Fitz, John yeah. Fitzgerald, so Rose's dad had been mayor of Boston at one point.
Rose Kennedy was obviously JFK's mother.
Right. Thank you. So a little bit about Joseph P. Kennedy, because he's the, there's a book up about him called, biography called The Patriarch.
Right. He definitely was that.
He is. And the important thematic thing here is what I would call sort of Irish American striving, right? That he is incredibly ambitious and is one of these Irish Americans who wants to sort of win acceptance for Irish Americans in American society, especially in American elite society.
Now, he starts off as a businessman.
As a businessman,
he doesn't
yes.
go right into politics.
Yeah, no, and he has a pretty humble upbringing, but he goes to, I think it's called Boston Latin. He goes to a good prep school, and he goes to Harvard, and immediately is an amazing success in business. Around 1915, I think he's maybe the youngest bank president in the entire United States.
Holy cow.
So, and he's, everything he, in his career, everything he touches turns to gold, basically. He becomes an incredible success in business. He's a success in Hollywood. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He even shrewdly manages his finances so he doesn't get horribly dinged by the Great Depression.
Yes, that's right. He makes it through the Great Depression.
Yeah, and it's actually an issue because JFK actually later remarked on this, that he knew nothing about the Great Depression growing up.
Right.
Because they were insulated from it. They had their millions, they had their mansions, they had their servants.
He was only 10-ish, 10
yeah,
or 12.
Exactly. Yeah. And they were upper out of sights. Anyway, so Joe Kennedy, very successful business person. So successful, by the way, that by 1940, just to put this in perspective, by 1945, when JFK is 28 and returning from the Navy, 1945, the dad had set up trust funds for the 9 kids, each of which in today's money is worth about $9 million.
Wow.
So the kids were never, ever would have to worry about money ever again, no matter what they did the rest of their lives.
Wow, that's amazing.
So he was incredibly successful. And he also went into politics. Basically, he became the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission under FDR.
Right. Now let's tell the buzzkillers what that is, because that's very important in depression terms as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. Yes. That was basically the New Deal reform intended to regulate the stock market.
It's, right. it's still after the crash.
After the crash, right? And FDR Roosevelt very shrewdly brought in a business person who knew about how Wall Street worked, and who was actually interested in regulating Wall Street, and apparently did a pretty good job. Okay. He was not as successful as ambassador to Great Britain in the late 30s. Pretty notorious for that failure. But in any case, he has 9 kids. They are all given sort of pampered upbringings. Most, if not all, are sent to elite prep schools. JFK mm-hmm. goes to Choate, mm-hmm. Elite Northeast prep school. And, you know, the dad definitely is preparing the kids for greatness. He wants, because he knows he can't be president. His ambitions sort of have sort of peaked by the 1930s, but he has great hopes for his children, especially the boys, of course.
And is there any sense, do we have any, I mean, it seems this way, but again, especially here at the Institute, we try to rely heavily on actual evidence. It seems as if the old man, Joseph P. Kennedy, is building up a clan and a clannishness politically as well as Irish clan.
Oh, yeah. No, and he's sort of on it. He's very, very interested in sort of managing the futures of his kids, if I can put it that way. And trying to be very strategic and trying to lay the groundwork. And he's throughout, he essentially retires from business by 1940 or so
and spends
a lot of time basically pulling strings for his kids, including JFK.
And he himself lives to the early mid-60s, right? I know he lives past the election.
He suffers a debilitating stroke in 1961, shortly after JFK becomes president.
Right.
And is sort of incapacitated. But yeah, he in the 40s, 50s, and 40s and 50s, he plays a big role in promoting the careers of his kids.
And of course, as we'll see later, Bobby Kennedy becomes JFK's campaign managers at various times.
And then attorney general.
And, right. And so there's a whole sort of concept and if you will, trope of we're all going to do this together.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. It was a very tight-knit family. They were very competitive with each other. And sort of the competitiveness was sort of schooled into them by the dad, mm-hmm. but they were very tight knit. And, you know, if you look at JFK's campaigns, including for president, but also for Congress and the Senate, he has, in military terms, you call a force multiplier. He's got this immense Kennedy clan that basically drops what they're doing and goes out.
Yeah.
And does the retail politics help get him elected?
And you don't have to pay for these people because they're already rich.
These people, although, of course, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and money is no object.
Right. Old man's already paid for them.
Absolutely, yes. When the old man, I mean, he starts pulling strings in JFK's case right away. I mean, look at World War II.
Right.
Where, back up a bit, JFK graduates from Harvard. He wasn't a very serious or great student, by the way. He sort of plays catch up his senior year and has his senior thesis published as a book, partly by dad pulling strings and mm-hmm. getting Arthur Kroc of the New York Times to rewrite it. It's called Why England Slept. It's about English sort of inactivity in the lead up to World War II.
Yeah, what is famously seen as appeasement.
Right, and sort of well-regarded. But anyway, he enlists in the U.S. Navy when World War II breaks out, and because of his physical infirmities, which we'll talk about later, he is basically not fit for combat. And mm-hmm. Dad has to pull strings to get him out of the Office of Naval Intelligence and into a combat command.
Now, do we have any idea, and again, Bosco, this is so hard to determine these things, especially when we talk later about his romantic dalliances and things like that. Do we have any sort of idea or evidence about why Joe Kennedy would want to pull his kids out of a safe job and into danger? I mean, I know there's the glory of danger and then.
Right. Well, that's part of it. I'm pretty sure that his thinking, like the thinking of a lot of other cases, for example, a lot of politicians mm-hmm. want to go and at least be in the military, if not be in combat. It's because they all recognize that's going to be sort of the coin of the realm afterwards.
And I wonder if, sorry, this is getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I wonder if Nixon felt that he suffered somewhat because he wasn't in combat. He was also in the Navy, but he wasn't in combat in World War II.
Yeah, that's possible. But also, there were cases, like you see this in the case of Joe McCarthy, there were cases where afterwards there was a lot of embellishment that went on.
Yeah.
You know, like the whole tail gunner Joe thing in McCarthy's case, where that was almost sardonic because, you know, you would pull strings to be on an airplane during a combat mission, and whether you actually really, quote unquote, saw combat is open to question.
Right, right.
But
right.
It's basically, it's going to sound crass, but it's basically ticket punching. In other words, you want to be able to have photographs of yourself in uniform, which you can use later for political purposes.
Okay. Okay.
But yeah, I think Joseph, from what I've seen, Joseph P. Kennedy recognizes that, you know, if my son only has a desk job in the Office of Naval Intelligence, that's not quite the same. Now, keep in mind that until 1944, he's the second son. He's not the first son.
That's right. The buzzkillers forget that generally.
And then that's really important because the oldest son is Joe Jr., mm-hmm. who's also in the military. And this is very sad, as I'll explain in a minute. But JFK is given a combat command. He's put in command of a patrol torpedo boat.
Mm-hmm. Famous PT boats.
The PT boats in the South Pacific around in the Solomon Islands. Which I've actually read a book about this, about the PT boats, including the other commanders of PT-109. And it's really, you have to give them a lot of credit for what risky duty this was.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
These boats, one of the other commanders of PT-109 referred to them as floating gas tanks.
Yeah, they're flimsily
built. They're made of
wood.
They're made of wood. They're 80 feet long. They rely on their speed to sort of get in, launch torpedoes and get out. They weren't very successful in terms of, you know, they complicated things for the Japanese, but it was basically very risky, as John F. Kennedy found out when his PT-109 was famously rammed by a Japanese destroyer mm-hmm. in the middle of the night.
Which apparently was not all that uncommon. Destroyers, I mean, I've read accounts where destroyer captains were purposely trying to ram ships, and so the destroyers were fast enough to do it.
Yes, they were fast, and it could happen to you. They could come out of nowhere, and you know, if you're just sort of floating there at a standstill in the middle of the night, where your visibility is measured in feet,
right?
You know, in the murk, there are no external sources of light. And there was some people who criticized JFK, but from what I've read, he was sort of exonerated.
Yeah. In other words, how could a little speedy motorboat be run over by a huge slow destroyer? It's just not like that.
Yeah, and it's not, in other words, it's not like monumental incompetence on his part or anything like that.
Yeah.
What he gets great credit for is afterwards, because his PT boat is sunk, it's cut in half, two men are instantly killed. Mm-hmm. And he, JFK, very effectively leads basically the rescue operation. Mm-hmm. And he's a very strong swimmer despite his physical infirmity. He was a very strong swimmer. He had been on the swim team at Harvard. Probably saved his life, but he successfully rescues his crew and risks his own life in doing so. And he was decorated for this afterwards. That was justified. But so, and he gets a lot of attention for this. And there's reason to believe that the older brother, Joe mm-hmm. Jr.,
who's serving in Europe at the time,
serving in the Navy in Europe, volunteered for an incredibly dangerous mission, partly because he felt like he had been upstaged by the younger brother.
Oh, so the PT-109 incident had already happened before?
Had already happened. That's August 1943 when PT-109 incident takes place. About a year later, Joe Jr. is killed on an incredibly dangerous mission, basically piloting a bomber, basically stripped of all its equipment and loaded with explosives.
Unlike a PT boat, but in the air.
In the air. No, actually, much more explosive, because the idea was that you sort of guide this plane toward the target was a German-controlled dam in Northern Europe. Mm-hmm. And then at the last minute, you bail out, and then the plane flies in the target and exploded. Well, for whatever reason, and it may have been because of a radio mishap, the plane apparently detonated over the English Channel.
Oh.
And so Joe Jr. was killed, and his body was never recovered. And this was, of course, a devastating loss. Mm-hmm. But this, of course, means then that the political weight, which had been put on Joe Jr.'s shoulders, now entirely shifts to JFK. He is now the oldest son, and all the sort of political hopes for the Klan are now placed on his shoulders.
Presumably he's still recovering, maybe even in a
Navy
hospital.
Yeah, in fact, he was like actually discharged from the Navy, I think, before the end of the war, because mm-hmm. his health problems were so bad. So then when he comes back from the war, there's a lot of pressure on him to run for Congress in 1946, which is what he does.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say that, because one of these things that's just come out recently, in fact, we have an audio clip of a speech he gave in a speech class at Harvard, which sort of shows us the kind of style he's going to adopt later on in running for Congress in 46. And in then, of course, his speaking style later on. Can you set it up for us? It's about Hugo Black.
Sure. Yeah. It's my understanding that he was a freshman or sophomore. I forget.
Yeah.
He was an underclassman at Harvard, and it was a seminar where I guess they are supposed to speak about any topic they choose, and he mm-hmm. chooses to speak about Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black.
Right. And whether Hugo Black is fit to be nominated because he'd been in the KKK.
Right.
Okay. Now the audio quality, Buzzkillers, isn't perfect. But we're going to play it for you now.
Right. And this is, if I can just interject, this is by far the youngest JFK you're ever going to hear, unless we discover some other tape. But, but this is, I'm unaware of anything before his congressional career, which starts in 47.
And by the way, recording stuff in a class.
Right.
The teacher's
really
playing
odd.
It back to you. That's unlikely.
Odd that it was recorded and odd that we still have it. So it's pretty amazing.
Well, again, here it is. It's a little scratchy, but I think you'll certainly get the pattern and the sort of speaking style, if not hearing the words perfectly.
My name is John F. Kennedy. I'm going to speak this morning on a subject we've spoken of twice before, Hugo Black. I'd like to take it from the angle of what's going to happen to Mr. Black, if anything can happen. We all know the circumstances surrounding Mr. Black's appointment to the Supreme Court. Whether Mr. Black's appointment to the court is a correct one, it's hard to say. It was evidently done in the heat of presidential anger at the conservative element who did not back Mr. Roosevelt's court plan.
Well, we're back. Scratchiness aside, it's a very interesting recording, and we see his kind of development of his political speaking style.
Right.
After all, it's a political topic.
Right, and also you see his early interest in politics.
Right.
I mean, he as an undergraduate, he is spending a lot of time chasing girls and doing sports and not attending to his studies. He did buck up his senior year. But he is definitely interested in his strongest subjects, by the way, were history and politics.
Right.
The other ones, not
the
so
best
much.
Subjects there are, by the way.
Absolutely.
For those of you
college. Why we're such big fans of him.
Yeah, and that's why we're rolling in it in terms of money.
By the way, I've looked, this is how perverse I am. I've looked it up. You can buy JFK study earrings, and I think I'm going to obtain, in honor of his 100th birthday, I think I'm going to obtain a pair.
Stud earrings.
Stud earrings.
I thought you said studio rings. Well, what the hell is a studio ring?
You'll have to glue me in.
Yeah,
don't. Yeah, you can get JFK earrings. Because on the internet, you can buy anything.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
It's not, as far as I know, it's not part of an overall sort of presidential earring series. Although there are presidential Pez dispensers. Did you know that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I know kids who collected them.
We are way off topic.
And they are made. They're really good. They do. Like, you can build up your own Pez Mount Rushmore if you want.
I'm slowly collecting them myself, actually.
Okay, back to the congressional race of 1946. We went to the Harvard thing after the war because we wanted to talk about the political trajectory here. So he went to Harvard, went to the war, came back from the war, and now in 46, is there a family confab where they say what's Jack going to do?
And it's interesting because until around 1945, if you had asked him, like, what do you want to do with your life, his interest was to be a journalist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
He was not interested in politics, but by 46, I'm assuming Dad tried to persuade him, and probably didn't have that much trouble. But yeah, he runs for Congress, and of course in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it's obviously a Democratic stronghold, and so the important election is the Democratic primary. It's a very crowded field. I think there were 8 candidates, but he won partly because he was a war hero, partly because of his dad's money and his dad's effort at promotion.
Mm-hmm.
There was in the New Yorker. There was a big article done on the PT-109 thing during the war.
Oh, okay. So I thought that was after the war. So it was during the war.
Yeah, after the war, it's promoted too. But during the war, it does get some attention. And I believe it was in the 46 campaign where Joe, the dad, has 100,000 copies of the article printed and distributed to voters.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing. They were relentless. They, in all their campaigns, they just sort of ground the opposition down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it happened that he was a pretty good candidate, and he had a very strong war record, and so he won the primary and got elected to Congress. 1946, so he's part of his freshman class is the same in Congress, is the same as Richard Nixon's. They enter Congress together.
Right,
1946,
right.
And he serves 3 terms.
And there are a number of congressmen coming out of the war.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And that election is a kind of a young class.
Yeah. And partly because a lot of the voters are going to be veterans themselves.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Millions and millions of people served in the military in World War II.
In one way or another,
And that they shared that experience. And so that's going to be one of the things they're looking for in a candidate is, do you understand me as a veteran?
Right.
So that was really, really important and helped them get elected.
Do we have any sense of, is there myth-making or mythologizing about his years as a congressman, or is that just...
No, I don't think there's any myth-making. I mean, he wasn't... I mean, first of all, in the House, it's hard to leave a mark in any case, although Richard Nixon did with the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah, that's true.
Helped make him a household name. In fact, I'd argue in that period, 46 to 52, roughly, Nixon is a much bigger household name than the young John Kennedy. But Kennedy does then in 52 successfully challenge the incumbent U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, Henry Cabot Lodge, Republican, obviously.
And Henry Cabot Lodge is not a nobody.
No, not a nobody. He's an incumbent, and in 52, a very Republican year. That's what's really important.
Sure. Eisenhower year.
Eisenhower is elected. 20 years of Democratic dominance of the White House has finally ended.
Mm-hmm.
But JFK handily upsets this incumbent and pretty popular Republican U.S. Senator from Massachusetts.
Right.
And already you see what's going to become a pattern, which is there wasn't a real big policy difference between the two of them.
Oh, no kidding. I always thought, okay.
Because Kennedy, talk about this later, Kennedy was a relatively, and I stress relatively conservative Democrat, especially for the Northeast. And Lodge was one of these relatively liberal Republicans back when that was a thing. So on you look at the issues, there's not much separating them. Well, what's separating them are things like image and glamour and youth and good looks.
And
Lodge, JFK has those in spades, and Lodge not so much.
Yeah, Lodge is an older man.
Yeah.
And seems
not ugly or anything, but he doesn't have the sort of proto rock star quality that JFK already has in 1952. And so then
and again, there are fleets of Kennedys spreading out all over Massachusetts campaigning.
Absolutely.
For him,
yeah.
And everyone wants to go see Bobby and all.
A lot of these opponents of JFK after they lose, they're basically like, they don't know what hit them. Like they sort of underestimate Kennedy. and partly because he didn't have the strongest record, and so they're sort of thinking basically in the old terms, like what do you have to prove? You know, what do you have to show for your 6 years in the House? And it turns out that's less and less important if you look like John Kennedy does. Yeah,
well, that's true, and probably even when Kennedy's in the House from 46 to 52, he's not as not concentrating as much on bringing home the bacon as lots of congressional House of Representatives members are. And but as you say, that's becoming less and less important,
right,
as the century
goes on.
Now it's true.
I mean, he did some of the basic sort of bread and butter stuff of politics, but already when he's in the House, for example, he's much more interested in foreign relations than in domestic issues.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So he enters the Senate in 1953, which is the same year he gets married.
Oh, yes. Which was not uncovered by the press.
No, not uncovered by the press.
Lightly covered by the press, I should say.
Go online, by the way, Buzzkillers. Lots of photos of the JFK wedding in September 1953.
And movies, films.
Yes. And it is interesting because he marries, of course, the young Jacqueline Bouvier, from sort of an elite background. 12 years his junior, by the way.
Oh, wow. They don't look that big difference.
No, that's true. He was 36 and she was 24. And by the way, it's pretty clear one of the reasons he gets married is because he has political ambitions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I personally think that he would have been happy to continue to be a quote unquote confirmed bachelor because basically, we'll talk about this later, he loved sleeping around. But especially in the early 50s, during the time of the so-called Lavender Scare,
You had to avoid
any suggestion that you weren't sort of completely, quote unquote, normal or conventional in terms of your home life. So you really needed to get married.
And let's remind the Buzzkillers what Lavender Scare meant at the time.
In the early 50s, during parallel to the McCarthy period, there was a witch hunt against alleged homosexuals in government, especially the State Department, which was in some ways just as vicious as the anti-communist
the
witch
Red
hunt.
Scare,
and they were related, by the way.
And you know, it's not as if the JFK campaign can go out and say, well, no, he's a raging heterosexual, because that's not a good image either.
Right. Well, and it's not like, as far as I'm aware, there was no whisper campaign about him.
Everyone knew he
was relentlessly heterosexual, but not only to avoid the sort of suspicions, but just to sort of on the positive side, look, here's a good family man, right? It makes good political sense to get married and have kids, right, which he does. He has two successful births in 57 and 60.
Right.
Caroline Kennedy and John, 57 and 60.
Right. But then, even after the election of 52, which, as you say, is a big upset in Massachusetts, the marriage in 53, they don't rest on their laurels, the Kennedys. They want to keep this publishing stuff, promotional material.
They are still putting in sort of the building blocks in case. By the way, it's often overlooked. In 56, he tries to get on the Democratic ticket as the vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is an interesting what if, because first of all, do you know who the actual winner of the vice presidential nomination was in 56?
Well, I'm a buzzkiller. I'm on my back foot here. I'm going to guess it's Stymington. No?
No, that's a good guess. No, but it's Estes Kefauver of Tennessee.
Oh, that's right. Say that four times fast, buzzkiller. It's like
kind of a good news, bad news kind of thing. Hey, you get to be Adlai Stevenson's running mate again and get to be thrown under the Eisenhower steamroller. Yeah. But so in other words, had he gotten that, it might not have worked out as well for him, but he did gain.
That's true. It could be a graveyard. Yeah.
Yeah. He did gain some stature from that attempt. And that same year, 1956, he famously publishes his book Profiles in Courage.
Okay. Which of course we all read as, you know, teenagers.
Which won the Pulitzer Prize. But this is an interesting sort of case study because it's pretty clear from all the latest biographies that, I'll put it this way, he was at best co-author of that book.
Oh.
And at worst, he was sort of marginally involved in the writing of that book. Oh, you know, okay. And there's some wiggle room there, there's some disagreement, but it's pretty clear that people like Ted Sorensen and other, including, and also some professional historians helping out, provided a lot of the material. Sorensen, I think, wrote some of the draft chapters, if not all the draft chapters. The story at the time was that, you know, Kennedy basically was, by the way, laid up in the hospital.
Yeah.
Because he had a near fatal back surgery. At best, he's a co-author.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to say it wasn't ghostwritten. It's not like he had, like he had nothing to do with it. That's unfair. But it's also unfair to his co-authors to say that he did it.
And we should remind sitting U.S. senators that we have a ghostwriting division here at the Buzzkill Institute. Just email us.
Always looking for work.
Absolutely.
In any case, and then the book not only does well, but it by the way, partly with the dad buying up all sorts of copies, which is way ahead of its time. That's how you That's how you pump sales today on Amazon, for example. There have been lots of cases of that recently, but dad buys up a lot of copies,
gives them away.
He also through Arthur Kroc, the ever reliable Arthur Kroc,
New York Times.
He intervenes with the Pulitzer Board. Apparently, I didn't even know this. At the time, the Pulitzer judges, they basically have a jury, and then they have a sort of a board of directors or board of editors or something
like
that.
Sort of like an electoral college for the Pulitzer Prize to make sure people don't get it wrong.
Exactly. That's sure what it sounds like. Apparently, the jurors actually put this book like number 5.
Oh.
But what do you know? It ended up with the Pulitzer Prize, and it's pretty clear that that's Joe Kennedy pulling strings once again. Now, okay. I mean, at the end of the day, does it really matter, right? Would he have not been elected president in 1960 if he hadn't won the Pulitzer Prize for Paul and Courage? But is also interesting because it's almost like this wish fulfillment, because the book, in case the Buzzkillers don't know, it's about each chapter is on a different U.S. senator from history who, as Kennedy argues, went against what was politically expedient, went against a majority of his voters to, quote unquote, mm-hmm. do the right thing. Yep. So profiles and courage. No evidence that I'm aware of that JFK ever did anything courageous as a senator.
Oh, he doesn't take an unpopular stand.
I mean, you could maybe labor racketeering.
Okay.
Because he is one of the senators leading the charge against, you know, the Teamsters.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this is a time when pretty serious corruption was being exposed in the Teamsters. And, you know, the big powerful unions like the Teamsters are, of course, one of the pillars of the Democratic Party.
Sure, so,
I mean,
sure.
You could argue that's kind of courageous. But apart from that, he was, at the time, he was not known as sort of a big sort of mover and shaker in the U.S. Senate, not like, for example, Lyndon Johnson.
Okay. And also,
who was majority leader. But
Kennedy's criticized for being soft on McCarthy.
Yes.
When he comes up for censorship.
Yes.
Yeah. Although there's a counter argument that he was in the hospital and stuff.
Right.
So it's hard to tell.
You're absolutely right. That's an important controversy because his dad was actually pretty tight with Joe McCarthy.
Oh, there
and
you go.
And partly what JFK is doing throughout this period is obviously trying to rely on dad, but also trying to distance himself from dad because dad was so toxic in so many ways as a quote unquote appeaser from before World War II and basically being too conservative and sort of in league with the wrong people like McCarthy.
But as you say, we talked about before the show, the Profiles in Courage title comes back to haunt Kennedy almost a decade later. Yes.
And I didn't look too closely into this, but already in 1957, journalists like Drew Pearson are having fun with this phrase. But later on, it actually this phrase shows up on placards, actually before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people are unhappy. Because people think, some people on the right think that JFK is too soft on Cuba. They hold up signs that say, less profile, more courage.
Oh, right. Which is right, getting right at the image thing.
Yeah, it's like President Kennedy report to the burn unit. I mean, it's pretty pretty harsh, but...
buzzkill burn.
Exactly. Sick buzzkill burn. Yeah. He was kind of asking for it. But
the
book did make a splash. There's no question.
Yeah, and he doesn't have a remarkable career in the Senate, but I think we can say that the campaign of 1960 is a very remarkable thing,
if
at least in terms of its just being famous.
And by the way, I mean, I don't want to go too far. It's not like he was a backbencher in the Senate. He was on the Foreign Relations Committee. You might argue he took kind of a bold stance in coming down hard on sort of the European allies for their dragging their feet when it comes to decolonization.
Okay.
Yeah, he sort of took a bold stance on that and took some heat from people like, you know, party elders like Dean Acheson on that issue. But he was not a star in the Senate.
Okay.
And a lot of people at the time were like, wow, this is a young man in a hurry.
Yeah.
Why don't you sort of pay your dues before you run for president? And that was and there was people who didn't vote for him in the Democratic primary in 1960. That was part of their reservations. Too young, too untested, hasn't accomplished much. Like, why do you get to be president?
But, you know, as we know and as we've hinted at, we've had a couple of shows on related themes, the 1960 elections, full of myths, including myths built up by the Kennedy people.
Right. And by the way, before we get into them, It is an impressive win because he's up against some strong figures. But once again, his family, his money. In fact, I just found this out. Hubert Humphrey, who later infamously becomes LBJ's vice president and pays a very, very heavy price for that. Apparently, one of the reasons why he did it is because of his experience in 1960.
Because he ran in the Democratic primary against JFK.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He ran in the Democratic Party. He was probably JFK's main rival.
Yeah.
And loses badly, and partly because he has no money.
Ah.
And so he concludes by 1964 when he agrees to be Lyndon Johnson's running mate after this period when we don't have a vice president. I think we mentioned it in an earlier show. He basically decides that the only way he's going to become president ever is to become vice president first, because then he'll have sort of the gravitas and the connections to actually get elected president without having the Kennedys' deep pockets.
Right, right.
Because he really was. Financially, he was blown away in like, for example, the West Virginia primary and the Wisconsin primary.
Sure.
Which were really, really important. In any case, JFK gets the Democratic nomination in 1960, and then it's a fascinating election. It's one of the closest in American history.
Mm-hmm.
In the popular vote, sensitive issue these days, in the popular vote, he wins by only 120,000 votes.
Yeah.
In fact, his margin of victory in the Electoral College is similar to Trump's.
That's right. It's in the 300s.
Yeah, early this season, low 300, I think 303. A couple went to a sort of a splinter Dixiecrat candidate, Harry Byrd, I think.
Yeah.
As you know, our Electoral College tends to magnify the result in one direction or the other. But there are these myths. One is involved in the famous televised debates against the Republican candidate Richard Nixon, which you did an entire podcast on, right? The whole myth about and I always use this in class too. I was guilty as anybody. The idea that people listening on a radio thought Nixon won the first debate, and those who watch on TV thought JFK.
And there's no evidence for
No evidence for that. That was based on a really, really weak read. It does point to a larger truth, which is Kennedy represents what's called the new politics.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because if you watch the debate and listen to the debate, and there are lots of YouTube clips of this, Nixon wastes a lot of time saying, oh, well, this is what Senator Kennedy says, and then Senator Kennedy says this and believes this, and I agree with Senator Kennedy about it. Disagree. He keeps mentioning Senator Kennedy.
Right.
And what you're doing is you're just giving him more attention by saying that over and over and over again.
And partly this is because Nixon, I think in Nixon's own mind, he was a very skilled debater.
Right, yeah.
And once again, probably didn't know what he was up against. But also, even if people didn't, even if there wasn't this disjuncture between listeners and viewers, it's true that Kennedy is popular and successful partly because of his image, partly because of his appearance, his sort of his coolness, you know, how youthful he is.
But he doesn't take the TV debates forensically, in the sense that he isn't trying to score points with the panel of judges. Kennedy is sidestepping the judges, overlooking the judges, looking right at the audience.
Speaking to the viewer, right. And he understands he's on television and not in a debate. Right.
But also the content. Again, one of the things we stress in that episode about the 1960 debate, the content is incredibly deep from both of them.
Sure.
I mean, nothing like what we have now.
Yeah. And in case I forget to mention it later, I urge the Buzzkillers to go and watch a clip from one of JFK's news conferences as president.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, by the way, he did not hold as often as, say, Truman or Eisenhower did, which I was interested to learn. But when he has them, his command of issues is amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. He was very, very sharp and very, very up on issues and had an incredible head for sort of detail. No question about it.
He was a reader, as they say.
But his campaign in 1960, you can argue, is partly about sort of the triumph of style over substance, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of campaigns, maybe even more so, a lot of vague assurances about, you know, I'm going to get the country moving again. And there's this sense of malaise after 8 years of Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's sort of the old general, and you've got the young sort of celebrity who's sort of hip and hangs out with the Rat Pack. And, you know, I think there's almost like a cult of youth that sort of takes over. Along with the sort of the packaging and the use of television,
right.
Television is enormous by 1960, and that's where a lot of people get their information. And huge audiences for those debates. They were the first ever, first ever, not just on television, first ever.
You've never
had presidential debates ever in American history.
And the two party organizations had to agree to them: the DNC and the RNC.
Yeah, they're sort of making it up as they go along.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
But In any case, there are other myths. One is that another myth is that basically it was voter fraud that won the election for JFK. Mm-hmm. You can find a lot of people who still think this.
Yeah.
You can find a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, sure, he won, but he didn't really win.
He stole all of it. Mayor Daley stole the votes from Chicago.
There were too many dead people voting in Cook County, Illinois, or in Texas. If you look into this, it's a really complicated thing. There's a lot of work on this.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, there's no solid evidence that voter fraud swung the election. Right. There was voter fraud. By the way, at that time, there was voter fraud in almost all elections.
Yeah, sure.
But if you look
probably at... Probably easier to get away with
but
than
if you
now.
In other words, the evidence they found, and they looked into this at the time. There were investigations. Mm. There were legal proceedings. There were recounts in several states. There was in Hawaii. I think they actually changed the result twice.
Oh,
based
no
on
kidding.
Based on recounts.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But in any case, in Illinois, even if you acknowledge the alleged number of funky votes, they weren't enough to change the result.
Oh, okay.
So, and for example, Seymour Hersh wrote a book in the late 1990s called The Dark Side of Camelot, which claimed, among other things, that mob money helped swing the election. Most historians have dismissed that claim as mm-hmm. not based on sufficient evidence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in any case, basically there's no, and by the way, if you look at Illinois, downstate in the Republican bastions, there were also some irregularities.
Yes, that's the famous counterbalance. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, is it possible? Yes, but there's not enough evidence. And for this kind of claim, which is a very serious claim, you have to have sufficient evidence, which we just don't have.
Sure, sure.
So pretty clear he won fair and square. And the third myth is that Richard Nixon did not contest the result. And I know you've talked either with or talked about David Greenberg, who's a great scholar. And he's always very, very adamant and correctly so that while Nixon himself may not have personally challenged the result.
Well, or not publicly personally. You
right.
know what I mean?
His people and his campaign are working very, very hard to challenge the result, including in court, including basically forcing recounts in several states. And, you know, because that's always, Nixon was, you know, this bad guy, but he was really classy in 1960
conceding
a tainted result. And that's just not true. Neither half of that claim is true, but it was an incredibly close result. If you look at sort of the fundamentals of the 1960 campaign, Democrat X should have won much more handily than JFK did.
Oh.
A majority of voters in 1960 sort of identified themselves as Democrats.
Even though someone like Humphrey might have been considered boring?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, if you look at the fundamentals, like, in other words, you're coming after 8 years of the other party. The economy was sluggish. Mm-hmm. We were basically in a mild recession. If you look at the instability in world affairs, like I said, Republicans had been in power for 8 years. You had a very attractive candidate, certainly a superior campaign. The Nixon campaign was not the sharpest operation. He made mistakes, like, for example, promising to campaign in all 50 states.
Yeah.
And then he spends a lot of time in the fall visiting all 50 states, which is a total waste of time.
Because, of course, Montana has two electoral college votes.
And there's, like today, maybe not quite like today, but certainly back then, too, you had safe states and you had battleground states.
Right.
Spend your time in the battleground states. That's just strategy 101. So Nixon
travel was slower.
Mistakes.
Yeah.
But still, and despite all these things that sort of point to a big Democratic win, it's not a big Democratic win. And it's pretty clear from all the things I've seen that the basic reason is Kennedy's Catholicism.
Yeah.
I mean, he does a pretty good job of handling the issue. He famously goes before this group of Protestant ministers, sort of goes into the lion's den at this mm-hmm. meeting of Protestant ministers in Houston and handles himself very well and impresses people a lot.
Although I've always wondered... He keeps talking about, in all those instances, including the debate and Meet the Press things, there's a very famous Meet the Press 1960 episode. He keeps saying, we shouldn't base the election on my religion, because both of them were Christian. And by the way, Nixon was a Quaker. And mm-hmm. if you're going to be a real Quaker, you're going to be very anti-military.
Right.
Right? And he wasn't. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't the Kennedy people have been smart enough to say something like, my denomination rather than my religion, because my religion makes it sound like you're a different religion from Christianity.
Right.
But, you know, they didn't have me on the staff in the Hyannis part at the time.
But also, that's a real good point. The way I would interpret that or sort of address that is, I think the division between Protestants and Catholics was so much more profound then than it is now.
Yeah,
that
right.
A lot of Protestants would say, no, that's not
it's
a Christian.
Completely different religion. Yeah, it's a different religion. Okay.
And you know, it's not 1928. 1928 is the year when we have our first Catholic candidate for president and he gets stomped on.
That's Al Smith.
He's just blown out in large part because of Catholicism. So here we are 32 years later. There's still quite clearly a lot of anti-Catholic animus.
Oh, of course, there would be older people who had voted in 28.
There would still be a lot of older people still around. Okay. Still a lot of people were feared that a Catholic president would not be sort of completely loyal to the United States, but would take orders from the Pope.
Yeah.
It's almost absurd to think about it in retrospect, but that's what a Catholic candidate was up against even in 1960. Now, by the way, he got a lot of Catholic votes that he might not have otherwise gotten.
Right.
But apparently the studies, and there's good data on this, the studies show that there was a big net loss of probably between 1.5 and 2 million votes.
So holy cow.
So he gained, and by the way, a lot of the Catholic votes he gained were in sort of safe Democratic states. So they didn't really matter that much for him.
Yeah.
Where he
Northeast.
Whereas he apparently does lose some states because of Protestants voting against him because he's Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But still, about 1.5 to 2 million votes, which is a lot. So in other words, it should have been a comfortable Democratic victory, and it wasn't. It was a nail biter. Very, very close.
Well, we have the very secret reason, the very special reason why Kennedy won the election, and we're going to hear all about that from our sponsors at Harry's Razors. Back in a minute. Buzzkillers, you know, time and time again in various episodes, we've told you why JFK won the 1960 election. He certainly won the West Virginia primary over Hubert Humphrey because of Harry's Razors. He certainly won the debate over Nixon later in the campaign because of Harry's Razors. And he went on from there, from strength to strength. He looked fantastic. And Lady Buzzkill wants you to know that although you can't see me because this is a podcast, I assure you that I look and feel fantastic. That's because I use Harry's Razors to fuzz kill unsightly stubble, and I save money at the same time. Why is this true? Because for centuries, going back to biblical times, rip-off razor companies have been coming out with the newest versions of their blades, upcharging you, raising their already high prices. But two fantastic buzz killers, Jeff and Andy, decided to stop all that. They founded their own razor company. They bought their own razor factory in Germany so they can oversee all the production. And they ship the blades right to you, cutting out the middleman. Their prices are still just $2 per blade compared to the $4 or more per blade that you're going to pay at the drugstore for those ripoff razors. You know I love the razors. The great soft flex hinge, the great lubricating strip which keeps the razor going, the trimmer blade, and of course the handle is nice and meaty and fantastic. Not only that, with your membership, Harry's mails the razors right to you on the schedule that you set up. So you're never, ever left in the rough. And of course, as you know, as we've said many times, Harry's has a special offer just for buzzkillers. If you go to harrys.com, enter the code buzzkill at checkout, you get the great razor, the 5-blade cartridge, the shaving gel, and their post-shave balm for free. You only pay a pittance for the shipping. It's $3 for the best shaving experience of your life. And it'll keep going on because you'll have your membership. You'll look great and your face will feel great all day, even if you're only heard and not seen, like me. Do it now, buzzkillers. Back upstairs. Okay, we're back. And it's clear from what we said down there in the sponsorship department that Harry's makes you healthier. But health, Professor, was a very serious thing for JFK, especially
Absolutely.
Early on.
And there's some health issues that even the best razors can't solve.
Well.
No, that's some of the recent biographies, and particularly Bob Dalek's 2003 biography, which apparently has done quite well. And I just learned recently has done quite well in Great Britain, of all places.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's came out in 2003. I think it's called John F. Kennedy, An Unfinished Life.
It's
a great book, and one of the reasons it's great is because he got first access to a lot of Kennedy's medical records that we did not have access to.
Oh, okay.
And so we know a lot more. It's not, by the way, there's still debates about it. about its true nature. There's a lot to discuss, but we have a much clearer picture of his health problems, and there's good reason to believe. Now, obviously, there were people like Woodrow Wilson who had a stroke while he was in the White House.
Yeah.
We've had presidents with bad health.
And FDR was more or less dying post-44.
FDR had horrible health last year of his life, no question. But if you look at sort of the list of chronic conditions, I think you can make a good argument that I know our current president has the best health ever of any of any president.
Absolutely.
But
of any human.
JFK may have had the worst health of any president.
Wow. Because that's completely different from the image.
Exactly. And that's part of the story here is that this huge image, his and his whole family's image for their sort of athletic activity, right? The touch football at Hyannis Port, the sailing, right? He stressed the importance of physical fitness, right? The whole presidential physical fitness thing was basically created by John F. Kennedy.
Yes, that's right. The Committee on Physical Fitness.
He wrote an article in Sports Illustrated about how we've become sort of soft and lazy and indulgent. By the way, it's a lot like what's going on when Teddy Roosevelt was president. There's a real link there, but in the whole masculinity thing, there's a real connection.
And also there's a sort of parallel with it. We're flabby as a health, flabby in health serves the country. The economy is flabby. And
yes.
It's a flabby.
Right. And the whole get the country moving again. Slogan sort of captures so much of this idea. So the picture, he was the picture of health, right? Always tan, trim. Yeah. You know, fit, immaculately tailored, right? He's 6 feet tall. He's got great hair. I mean, he really was sort of the complete package. But behind the scenes, he had horrible health that was very successfully hidden.
Amazingly successfully.
Yes. I mean, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that if people had a full understanding of his health in 1960, he might not have been elected president.
Right. May not have won the Democratic primary.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, in case I forget to bring it up, during the 60 campaign, somebody, we don't know who exactly, broke into his doctor's office looking for his files.
A pre-Watergate Watergate.
We don't know, but it may have been Nixon people.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know, right?
make sure the buzzkillers don't go out and turn this into another urban legend / myth. Although, actually, go out and do that, because then we can have a whole other show.
Exactly. Got to feed the beast.
Yeah.
But here was an MD who was very shrewd. His JFK's records were filed under someone else's name.
Oh, that's
so
how that happened.
They went looking through the files, looking for Kennedy, didn't find anything. The papers were there, but they were filed under another name. Very clever.
That reminds me, I got to call my doctor tomorrow and ask for the same
sort of
arrangement.
Would you clean that up, please? In any case, he was, like I said, not fit for combat in the U.S. Navy during World War II. As a young child, he had scarlet fever.
Oh, yeah, which was very serious back in late teens, early 20s.
Yes. And he is never without health problems.
Wow.
Never. Has all these chronic issues. Like I said, he almost dies in 1954 when he undergoes surgery because he was so miserable. He had basically an extremely weak and unstable lower back, which caused him excruciating pain. You can actually find pictures of him on crutches. Even as president, there were times when he walked around with crutches and had his famous padded rocking chair that was apparently particularly good for his back.
And that was later attributed to his war injury and being knocked around.
And there was a lot made of his allegedly having contracted malaria in the South Pacific.
Yeah.
That may or may not be the case. Because, by the way, he had these adrenal issues, which can cause jaundice-like symptoms. And so people say, oh, it's the malaria.
Well, that was from when he was born, basically, or an infant. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and at one point, they actually measured his cholesterol at one point at 358.
Wow.
Now, let's not be presentist. Cholesterol was not the obsession back then that it is now.
Yeah.
And doctors might not have said, oh, we need to do something about this. By the way, they didn't have the same tools that we have.
Also makes me regret the buzzkill donuts we had this morning.
Oh, those were cholesterol free.
Oh, okay.
But still, he even had super high cholesterol. At age 30, he's diagnosed with Addison's disease. And the only Addison's disease, by the way, is a disease. It's a disease of the adrenal glands, which sit on top of the kidneys.
Ugh.
And the good news is his timing was exquisite. If he had contracted Addison's disease a few years earlier, it might have killed him. Because it was a death sentence until they basically discovered corticosteroids.
Oh, okay. Oh, steroids. All
so
right.
He was giving, he was at age 30, he is diagnosed with this. And by the way, you can see pictures of him like when he's running for Congress in 1946. He is skeletal.
Skeletal, absolutely.
He, I mean, I'm pretty sure that it's accurate to say he was basically 6 feet tall and 150 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. And you get very noticeable.
And he's swimming in his suit, and he just looks like hell. Yeah. And it's partly the Addison's disease. But like I said, he starts taking, by the way, when he was assassinated, the autopsy discovered that he essentially did not have adrenal glands. They had basically shriveled up to nothing. And so he was on cortisone. At times he was over-medicated, and I think part of the issue here is that he's one of these people, especially when he's in the White House, when he has the slightest discomfort or malady or doesn't feel good, he runs to the doctors and the doctors give him what he wants.
Yeah. And there are doctors, I think, in the White House because of some of these JFK tapes, he calls up and says, can you bring me down the blue pills?
Yes. And that's part of the problem is that like a lot of presidents or a lot of famous people, he sometimes has multiple doctors who don't have a clear picture of what the other doctors are doing.
Oh, yeah.
That gets straightened out later on. But in his first year in office, it's actually part of the problem.
Yikes.
He's definitely over-medicated at certain times. And he does see the famous Dr. Feelgood referenced in another episode. Mm. His name is Max Jacobson. He was sort of a doctor to the stars. Did not have hospital privileges, by the way.
Ugh.
Was an MD. Later in the 70s, he actually has his license yanked.
Ugh.
At the time, he's a Dr. Feelgood. He's available to give you injections to make you feel good.
Yeah.
And JFK, especially in his first 6 months to a year in office, is visiting Dr. Feelgood, I think sometimes like twice a week.
Wow.
And getting these injections, which include all sorts of funky stuff.
Including placenta.
Including
which is
placenta.
Just
if this sounds
weird.
A little like Dr. Theodore Morell working for Hitler, that's because there are kind of some overlap there in terms of their medical practice. So he's getting these, and in retrospect, it's really irresponsible. JFK famously said at one point, "I don't care," and I'm quoting here, "I don't care if it's horse piss; it works."
Yeah,
and that was his attitude toward it. But these included amphetamines, and he got these injections at the time of the June 1961 summit with Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna.
Oh.
If people are unclear, people should go look up some of the side effects, possible side effects of amphetamines. They can affect your mood. They can make you paranoid. This is not something you want your president taking when he is negotiating in the deepest, darkest years of the Cold War.
Right, especially with a hardcore guy like Khrushchev.
Yeah, with the adversary, yeah. In any case.
But amphetamine is only one of the, you brought in a list of all these things. It's astounding.
This is circa August 1961. I'll just run down the list. Some of the things he's taking. He's taking codeine sulfate and procaine injections for his lower back pain. And that was part of the problem. He had one doctor, whose name was Janet Travell.
Mm-hmm.
Her solution for his back pain was to give him these painkilling injections, which was essentially just masking the symptoms.
Right.
And making his back weaker and weaker and weaker. Later on, she was sort of dismissed, and he stopped getting these injections and started doing physical therapy.
Yeah, he should have been doing yoga the whole time.
Exactly. And he strengthened his lower back, and his problem became much better.
I tell you, if he'd been running for president in the 21st century, I'm sure the Democrats, in fact, maybe even the Kennedy machine, would have had him in yoga pants out there campaigning, which seems to be the
hawking his workout video.
Yeah, the uniform du jour these days in coffee shops around America.
Yes, indeed. So codeine sulfate and procaine injections. He's taking B vitamins for his anemia. He's taking penicillin for his urinary tract infection. He's taking corticosteroids for his Addison's disease. He's taking Lomotil, trenzantine, and paragoric for his colitis. Today we would call it irritable bowel syndrome, apparently, which he had. So he had serious gastrointestinal issues. He was taking testosterone for his weight loss. And I think this is, by the way, the cortisone has side effects, including weight loss. And so to keep your weight up, you take testosterone.
This is a bucket of pills every morning.
Oh, yeah. And then you wonder like, okay, is this someone who really needs testosterone? More on that in a minute.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to have it.
Really? You? Yeah. He's taken Tuinol, I think it's pronounced, which is a barbiturate for insomnia. So, okay, once again, we've got the speedball. He's at certain times apparently taking amphetamine in the day and a barbiturate at night.
Wow.
At other times, he's taking antihistamines. He had horrible allergies.
Wow, this is astounding because you never hear that.
Nope. He had allergies, food allergies, but also allergies to pets and things like that and to pollen. And then there's also Dr. Feelgood's injections, which had amphetamine, steroids, calcium, placenta, and vitamins.
Wow.
It's possible, I read a very good article about this, it's possible he had this thing called APS2, which is autoimmune polyendocrine syndrome type 2, which apparently is a package of maladies that sometimes come together, not at the same time. But adrenal insufficiency and also hypothyroidism, which he exhibits later on as president,
right.
And then also pernicious anemia. These are the three things that come together with APS2. And it's not definitive, but it's possible that's what he was suffering from.
Okay, because it sounds like hyperthyroidism and pernicious anemia are two conditions that work against each other.
Right.
But apparently it sounds like the medications are working against each other.
Right, but apparently this is an actual syndrome, which they didn't even necessarily identify at the time. But in retrospect, if you look at his records, there's a very good article I read about this.
Well, all these things lead me to like it's almost as if JFK had his own health version of the Kennedy curse. His body's trying to kill him.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's amazing that someone can not just survive, but function as president of the United States with all of these issues, all these health issues.
Yeah. And so how did he function as
well,
president?
Well, and that's what's the amazing thing, and that he's given credit for by his biographers, including Robert Dalek, that they don't appear to have affected his performance. In other words, there's no reason to believe that, he didn't do so well on this issue or at this point in his presidency because of his health.
Because of the horse piss injections?
Right. And partly because I think he'd been raised to be tough. You know, the whole Kennedy's don't cry thing. That's part of it. So he was sucking it up. And Dalek gives him a lot of credit for basically soldiering on through all these chronic conditions that he suffered from. And had some grit and some courage to persevere.
The Buzzkillers, this is the Cold War. Technically speaking, there isn't a hot war going on, missiles flying around, but the tension is very high all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's not just the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we talked about. But, you know, there's a book about Kennedy called The Crisis Years.
Right,
and that's because
there's
always something going on. And the Cuban Missile Crisis, during those 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you want someone at the top of their game. Right. And then you look at this list, and it's like, even if it's just half as long, it's still pretty amazing that he is functioning. And not just functioning, but, you know, the pain of his back never really was solved and never really entirely went away.
Yeah.
And he was constantly sort of re-aggravating it. It was a huge, huge problem that he had to cope with, and apparently did.
Well, if Dalek is very careful and goes into great detail, if he says that is very, very strong evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think it's a pretty unassailable argument at this point. But it also points up this larger issue that concerns me personally, which is that we're still in the dark about our presidential candidates and our presidents. We still don't have nearly enough evidence about or information about the state of our candidates' health.
But we're also saying it's worse back then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it would be much harder to hide it now. And that, for example, there were people at the time who said, hey, doesn't he have Addison's disease? And they had to deny it. I mean, the rumors were out there, and they successfully sort of swatted them down. But yeah, I mean, my argument is that we still have a problem.
We
still don't force our candidates, and the stakes are high.
Absolutely.
We still don't force our candidates, for example, to take sort of a physical from some independent doctor, which I don't think is an unreasonable expectation.
No. At the very least, there should be sort of peer pressure from other candidates, and also peer pressure from press pressure, if you will.
You know, and today from forget about candidates, and any president, can you imagine if any president of either party, if they had a really serious debilitating health problem, do you think we'd find out about it at the time? I really wonder.
Yeah.
I think the instinct would be to cover it up.
If they were good at covering up, then they would do it.
And if they could cover it up, I think they would try to just to reassure the country, which I think is really, really dangerous.
Well, also part of his health, or at least what Kennedy thought of as part of his health in a positive way, was his sex life. And I'm always fascinated by this because, you know, going through college and everything, you always hear about this raging sex life he had, this raging desire to sleep with different women all the time. But I was always skeptical. It's like, okay, we always hear this, but I never see any evidence. And of course, this was the 80s and stuff, and the evidence wasn't out yet.
Right.
So this
some of it was out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not as if, you know, fleets of women were coming out and publishing their memoirs in the 70s saying, oh yes, we were part of the...
No, but there has been a sort of a drip, drip, drip since the 70s.
Okay, all right.
And you, by the way, you are absolutely right to be skeptical. I think a lot of people are rightly skeptical about this, but I'm here to tell you that we have plenty of evidence that most of what you think is true is actually true. He did have, and by the way, we have good corroboration. We're not just relying on tell-all books, although the tell-all books have a lot of good information in them.
Right.
Think we have things like White House phone logs and White House appointment books that confirm a lot of some of the most prurient details in some of the affairs. For example, with Marilyn Monroe, there are a lot of phone calls to the White House and Marilyn Monroe, which really don't make any sense unless they're having an affair.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we have, we do, I mean, you're right to be sort of, because it is a, you know, it's a very titillating, it's a great story. You know, you, after a while it snowballs and you want to believe every rumor. We have really good evidence from a lot of sources and not just people who are trying to cash in.
Okay, I think that's important to remind the buzzkillers of that. One of the things historians really look for when we're trying to build up evidence for a case and an argument is lots of sources from different perspectives saying the same thing. So if you have, you can't, just one tell-all book isn't enough, but you have a tell-all book that also syncs up with phone logs and other things, then you're getting much, much closer to rock-solid evidence.
Right. And if someone like, for example, one of his mistresses was Judith Campbell, we'll talk more about her in a minute. She wrote a book in the 70s. And she shows up in White House appointment books.
No, I have to ask this. We probably don't know this because surely the White House secretaries didn't write out, or, you know, Judith Campbell's coming over for a nooner.
Right, exactly. You know? And then you wonder, because those, in other words, she might have been visiting even more often, right? Because someone like Evelyn Lincoln, who's Kennedy's secretary, she's going to err on the side of leaving such things out and not putting such things in, right?
But if they do sync up with when we have these sort of personal testimony.
Right, and these things were not available for a long time. And then they become released, and it's like, wow, why is he having so many phone conversations with this woman, Judith Campbell?
Right.
I mean, she has no official position, right? Yeah. She's not an expert. He's consulting. Clearly, they're having an affair. Okay. And you know, and you can corroborate things like when the affair starts and when it stops, right? I mean, you can do things like that with some of these ancillary sources. So he was clearly a sexual obsessive. He famously once said, "If I don't have sex at least once a day, I get a headache."
Wow.
Keep in mind that he's in a very sort of womanizing era. He's
true.
He's raised by a champion womanizer.
Joseph, the all Massachusetts champion.
He was state champion 10 years running. Joe Kennedy Sr. was legendary. By the way, Joe Kennedy, in one of the more sordid details, Joe Kennedy was someone who hit on his son's girlfriends.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Nice, right?
Yeah. No, so thanks, Dad.
Yeah, I mean, so clearly he's brought up in a milieu in which it is expected that you sleep around.
Yeah, but of course he's also hanging around with Sinatra and Peter Lawford and people
like
that. Sure, yeah.
And you know, his wartime buddies and his college buddies, these are all sort of traditional males who want to sleep around as much as they possibly can. You know, JFK, like I said, would have been happy to remain single. By the way, it's pretty clear that Jackie Kennedy at least suspected that he slept around at the time of their marriage.
Okay.
She had good, I mean, there was a good reason to believe she knew what she was getting into.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't excuse it at all. But
doesn't excuse his behavior at
exactly,
all.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Okay. Exactly. Right. So,
it kind of makes one wonder. Sort of like the medication thing. If we're now thinking that he does an amazing job despite of all the medication, so what about the sexual things? If Jackie's not going to divorce him, is it any of our business?
Right. And that's always a legitimate question. Like, to what extent, or why are we prying into this person's personal life if it doesn't affect policy? Well, I would make an argument that it actually does affect policy.
Oh.
Yeah, that there's there's a legitimate subject of study for a few reasons, one of which is just the basic issue of hypocrisy. This is not just anyone who's sleeping around. This is a man who, part of his image making and part of his packaging in his campaign, especially for president in 1960, is that he's a great family man.
Oh, okay.
So, not only is he young and dynamic, but he's got a great wife and he's got great kids and that he's a good father.
And the family man thing is a political message. It's being turned into a political message.
Right. Okay. And partly it's a message to older people. He's young, but he's safe.
Ah.
Right? He's a reliable guy. He's stable. He's got a stable home life. Look at how great he is with his wife and with his kids. You know, there were a lot of rumors at the time, of course, but also a lot of people would have said, wow, look, in other words, his campaign put this out there. This was part of the packaging. All sorts of photo shoots with the whole family.
Yeah.
Magazine articles about the whole family, the whole sort of life at Cape Cod, et cetera.
Yeah.
This is all part of the packaging. So it's very, very hypocritical. And by the way, in 1962, Jackie Kennedy went on a long vacation in the Mediterranean. She did this more than once. She was criticized at the time for not being a good mother.
Because she was gone for this trip.
Like, you know, you're supposed to be taking care of your kids. Why are you out gallivanting?
Wow.
So that makes this hypocrisy really sort of painful and really unfair.
Yeah.
He's, at the time, he's ironically, you know, she wasn't, as far as I know, she wasn't sleeping around at the time.
No.
Whereas he was sleeping around enough for 100 people.
Right.
And, you know, I would say, from what I've seen, in a typical week, he probably has 10 different partners. I mean, it's that voracious, his sexual appetite, including,
also,
by the way, Jackie's press secretary.
That also brings up the question of, you know, misuse of presidential time. I can't imagine.
Although, that's another interesting point. It's my understanding, he's not spending a lot of time with these women.
Oh, okay.
By the way, he did have apparently at least a couple of serious, quote unquote, affairs. In other words, where it's an affair of the heart. Not just, like Mary Pinchot Meyer. That was an actual affair, and he was sort of emotionally tied up with her.
Okay.
Most of his conquests were basically sex and then dismissal.
Wow.
And even someone like Judith Campbell actually writes about this. After a certain time, I began to feel like I was being used.
Yeah.
Used for sex. And it's quite clear that was basically his MO.
Wow.
In any case, so there is a hypocrisy issue. That makes it legit. Even more importantly, there are political implications. From early on, and we should probably do a show on J. Edgar Hoover. I know you talked about his alleged cross-dressing at one point.
Oh, yeah, but that was an early show. Where,
right.
Much more in depth.
J. Edgar Hoover's a fascinating guy. And one of the reasons he remains FBI director for life, a 48-year term as FBI director. And by the way, very topical, because one of the reasons why FBI directors are now limited to 10-year terms... J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, right.
who was indestructible. The Kennedys wanted to get rid of him like a lot of presidents did and couldn't. Why? Because he had the goods on all sorts of politicians.
Yeah.
From early on.
Sure.
It turns out during World War II, one of JFK's serious girlfriends was Inga Arvad. Whom in his letters the young JFK refers to as Inga Binga. By the way, she may have had ties to Nazi intelligence.
Oh,
this is during World War II. It's my understanding, we don't know this for sure, but that doesn't really matter. What matters is the suggestion, the possibility that he was sleeping with a Nazi spy.
Oh, okay. And what you mean by that is that Hoover could have used that against him.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes,
and domestic. Yes. Domestic FBI policy could have gone in a very different direction if Hoover wanted to do it.
That's the kind of thing that the FBI director says, this man is young and ambitious. I may need this someday, so I'll put it in my files, most of which were destroyed, by the way, when Hoover died. So we unfortunately do not have these voluminous files that he kept on everybody. But that's the kind of thing where it's the ultimate brushback pitch, right? You give me what I want. You keep me on. You don't mess with me. Otherwise, I can release some of this information I have on you going way, way back.
Wow.
And that just accumulates. In March 62, Hoover goes to Kennedy and says, by the way, we understand that you've been seeing a woman by the name of Judith Campbell. Well, this is a problem because Judith Campbell is also a girlfriend of Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana.
Right.
Now, that alone is some major blackmail potential in the hands of the director of the FBI, which has political consequences. It's one of the reasons why the Kennedys start to do things they don't want to do that the FBI director is asking for. For example, wiretaps on Martin Luther King Jr. and his campaign.
Yeah.
These are approved. The wiretap on, I don't think it was MLK himself at first. That comes later. It was on a guy by the name of Stanley Levinson, who was MLK's chief, sort of the highest ranked white person in his entourage, who was alleged communist, which of course is Hoover's obsession, among other things. These wiretaps are approved in March 62, and I'm pretty sure it's not a coincidence, the timing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Kennedy brothers, including his brother, JFK's brother, Robert Kennedy, who's attorney general.
Right.
And nominally, and I mean nominally, the FBI director's boss, agrees to these wiretaps. And it's partly because Hoover has so much dirt on the Kennedys.
And the Kennedys, do we know? I mean, it seems like they would be, but do we know? I.e., do we have evidence that this connection with, or at least one person removed connection with the Chicago mob thing, if that ever came out, that would remind people of the accusation of vote rigging in 1960?
Oh, actually, that's a good question. I don't think there were accusations at the time of mafia related.
Oh, okay, rigging. Okay.
That's a subsequent claim. I think it would have been an explosive bit of blackmail on its own.
Just on its own. Okay.
By the way, it's one of the reasons why he cuts ties with Frank Sinatra.
Which makes
Frank Sinatra livid. People should go read about Frank Sinatra's reaction to being sort of cut out by the Kennedys, because he had actually prepared his Palm Springs estate for a JFK visit. He actually had a concrete helicopter pad poured just for the occasion, and then JFK basically said, "Frank, I can't see you anymore.
Sorry, yeah. You're bad for my image."
Frank Sinatra was not happy anyway, because he had been tight. I mean, they had been pretty close. In fact, Frank Sinatra is how JFK met Judith Campbell in the first place.
Wow.
But of course, Frank Sinatra himself was always dogged by claims about his mob ties. So in other words, he's not just reckless. And by the way, he has sex with a lot of women who are complete strangers.
Yeah. Okay.
And also prostitutes, which, I mean, from a political standpoint, not from a personal standpoint, from a political standpoint, is a very serious business, right? Because if you don't know who you're sleeping with, maybe it's someone who's been put there deliberately for nefarious purposes, right? Yeah. I mean, maybe it's someone who's going to try and surreptitiously take photographs of the two of you. I mean, who knows? Well, who knows where that could lead?
Health and sexually transmitted disease questions. Right.
Now, if
that is the definition of recklessness.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. Now, if people are wondering, like, why would someone who's so ambitious and so intelligent take such risks? It's a really good question, right? Yeah. As far as we know, JFK was incredibly fatalistic.
Oh.
He more than once with personal acquaintances, he basically says, "You have to live like today's your last day on Earth." He was very fatalistic about being assassinated when he was president, by the way.
Yeah, he famously said to Robert Kennedy, they were in a tall building, and said, "Look, if someone up here with a high-powered rifle could do anything," and of course, someone with a high-powered rifle does. Yeah,
that's what happens, right? So, I mean, he's incredibly reckless, partly because at some level he doesn't care, that he wants to enjoy himself and sort of let the chips fall where they may.
Do we have any evidence about where the fatalism comes from? Is it from being sick as a young man,
or partly from his brushes with death earlier on
and in the war?
It's partly about the fact that by the time he's president, he's already lost two siblings to premature death.
His
sister Kick Kennedy was killed in a plane crash right after World War II, 1948. By the way, in case I forget to mention it, the first of the Kennedy offspring to die of old age.
Natural causes
is Rosemary, who dies in 2005. And she was the one who was very unfortunately lobotomized by at the orders of Joe Sr. without the knowledge of Rose, by the way.
Yeah, that's a very, very sad story.
Incredibly sad story.
So you go through, there's the young Joe is killed in the war, Kennedy, who dies during the war. Then John, then Ron. I don't know how Rose Kennedy didn't die of agony.
It's for all of their success and all of their wealth, they suffered an unbelievable,
awful price,
string of tragedies. There's no question about that. And so there are political implications involving, like, for example, the FBI. There are also national security implications in at least one case we know about. In 1963, one of his partners was a woman by the name of Ellen Romich.
Mm-hmm.
Who had ties with East German intelligence. And that almost became a scandal at the time. And this was a case where actually the Kennedys ended up thanking FBI, because Congress was getting involved. Congress was on the verge of investigating this.
And this is all recorded. I mean, when Congress is about to, you know, they don't do this in...
Right.
There's definite evidence and definite
record.
So this
easily could have blown up in Kennedy's face. This is about a month or two before his assassination. So this is fall of 63.
Wow.
When Congress is about to get involved, and they get in touch with Hoover, and Hoover basically puts them off. And Hoover basically suggests to them, if we investigate this, you don't know where this might lead. In other words, it might implicate members of Congress.
Oh, right. So basically what Hoover's saying is, look, we open this can of worms, then the congressional affairs.
Right. And in this particular case, because this involved this famous or infamous Senate aide who was a fixer by the name of Bobby Baker, who was basically a facilitator and put a lot of powerful politicians in touch with prostitutes and other women. And so in other words, the investigation of this particular woman with the president might spill over and also implicate a lot of senators and representatives. And trust me, Senator, you don't want to go there. And so they sort of dropped it. They dropped it, and Bobby Kennedy had her hustled back to Europe, and they successfully covered it up.
Wow.
But, you know, this involves national security, right? Russians or someone in the East Bloc goes with Kennedy's sort of behind the scenes and says, look, we have this evidence that you've been sleeping with a spy, so now do XYZ for us or we expose you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, would any president, including JFK, would they have said, you know what, I'm going to sacrifice my presidency and my political future to save the country? Would they have done that? I don't know. I'd prefer not to find out, frankly.
Yeah, that's right.
Once again, deeply irresponsible. At best, irresponsible.
Now, I hate to do this kind of speculation, Buzzkillers, because one of the things we try to rail against on this show is speculation, because we speculate about something on the show, and then, you know, 6 months later, it comes out that these two PhDs in history said that.
How come you're not doing a show on this?
Yeah, but also that our speculation turns into two professors have said this fact.
Sure.
Anyway, but the question is, if JFK is having all these affairs, why is he bothering to risk these national security questions or national security scandals? He could have affairs with
much safer women.
Well, in the United, you know, Hollywood women or women, just women he wanted to, you know, people from Kansas. Right.
By the way, there apparently were times when he essentially ordered, quote unquote, ordered women. In other words,
of a catalog.
Yeah. I mean, apparently there was the one instance, Dave Powers, who is a personal assistant, going back to 1946, sort of a, not really a fixer, but sort of a...
almost.
Yeah, but it's sort of a very close to the president and does a lot of his dirty work and a lot of his, you know, arrangements, et cetera. Apparently, Dave Powers asked him once, what do you want for your birthday? And JFK named a particular Hollywood actress.
Wow.
And he apparently delivered.
Yeah, and in other words, I hate to say this because it's so sexist, and it can be taken in such a sexist way, but there's a safe avenue for womanizing, and then there's a national security avenue for womanizing. Right. Why not take the safe one all the time?
And he did both. I mean, for example, there were these famous White House secretaries, I forget their names, but they were known as Fiddle and Faddle.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's having sex with them throughout his White House years. He does have some sort of long-term relationships. But then he also sleeps with women, just sort of one-night stands.
Yeah.
And like I said, with strangers.
Or also, as you discussed earlier, not even one-night stands, like one 15-minute
stand. Exactly right. There is one case we learned about recently, and it's because she was mentioned by name in a book by a historian, I forget which. And so she decided to write her own book, and her name is Mimi Alford. I think she has a different married name. She wrote a book recently. She was a 19-year-old White House intern. So remember, she's 19.
19. That's
he's in his 40s. Yeah. Okay. And he apparently took a fancy to her and started showing her around the White House. And in Jackie's bedroom, basically had his way with her. Mm-hmm. And they saw each other for a long time, pretty much up until the assassination. It's pretty tawdry. She does not claim sexual assault, by the way. She argues that it was consensual. And in her book, her main regret was that she didn't take into account the feelings of Jackie Kennedy.
Sure.
But she didn't really regret having the affair otherwise.
But he was the president. He was the glamorous president.
Very right. And he obviously wanted her. And so she sort of yielded. He did ask her later to perform oral sex on Dave Powers.
Yeah.
Which she complied with. And then he asked her to have oral sex on his brother, Ted, and she declined and apparently was very unhappy about that. But, you know, I don't think it makes me a prude to look at this and say, this is pretty sordid.
Yeah.
This is pretty tawdry stuff. This is not just the president sleeping around.
And it's not just the president sleeping around with women relatively close to his own age. This is really abusing the starry-eyed nature of a 19-year-old person.
Today, she would have good grounds for a sexual harassment suit.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
At minimum.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then you wonder, like, how many other stories are there like this that we just don't know about? Because, like I said, his appetite was so insatiable. Right. But it really doesn't make him look very good, I would say. And like I said, and not just sort of a prurient interest. I think there's a legitimate historical case to be made for the importance of this.
So what strikes me so much, Professor Moore, and I think what will probably strike the buzzkillers is, you know, on the one hand, you have this not only image of a Camelot presidency and a successful presidency, and lots of historians argue that it was a successful presidency. You have all these weird, frankly, and sordid things going on, things that, right, of course, you couldn't get elected dog catcher now if, right, you had them. How does the whole thing sort of work into the larger assessment of the Kennedy presidency?
Great question. Any assessment, any fair assessment of any politician or president has got to sort of take everything important into account.
Right, right.
This is part of it. I mean, you can't, you can't entirely separate this, as people would have done at the time. By the way, a lot of journalists knew this was going on, and they didn't report on it because that was just something you didn't do, and it wasn't considered cricket, and it wasn't considered important to report on that. So they just sort of tolerated. By the way, most of those reporters were males, and a lot of them were having affairs too.
Yeah.
Not like people don't have affairs today, obviously. Now we have websites that can help you do it. But,
really? Yeah. And one of those websites is not ProfessorBuzzkill.com, by the way.
You can get him as a sponsor, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
In any case, this was quite common at the time. Now, that doesn't excuse it, because as I was just arguing, it has real significant sort of substantive historical sort of weight to it.
But also it has these potential policy implications.
Right.
He's not compartmentalizing it by having affairs with people who, right, are not connected.
Right.
He's not going out and finding...
A lot of people, even people who had multiple affairs, were much more careful about it, and they didn't have nearly as much responsibility or power.
And they didn't have the affairs with people connected, right, to the mob or to the Russians.
Right. Nevertheless, I mean, like we do a lot of times on the show, I would argue this complicates the picture. Not that people didn't necessarily know about this, but I think if you want a fair assessment of the man and his presidency in history, you have to take this into account. It doesn't necessarily mean he was a bad or terrible president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's possible to be a good president despite these things, but nor should we just sort of airbrush these out of the picture. They're an important part of the story, and they complicate him and make him look like a real and flawed human like we all are.
Right. And if you take his broad career sweep into account, presumably he's having not only these affairs, but these medical issues and all the other things we've talked about, and none of them seem to bring him down.
Right.
And so he must be a success to a degree, a certain reasonable degree, in as a senator and as a president, because
exactly,
in fact, overcoming his own attempts to sabotage,
right,
his own life.
Exactly. Right. And it's in a way, part of it is luck.
Yeah.
And a part of it, I guess this is going to sound odd, but in a way, it's sort of a certain amount of skill. In other words, he can successfully keep these different sets of books in his life. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it, but obviously he pulls it off.
Yeah. And there is the tenor of the times, which a lot of stuff is hushed up or ignored, right, or not considered wrong.
Or not considered important. But like I said, if some people had known about the stuff we know now, I think they would have looked at him very differently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, there you have it, buzzkillers. Complications throughout even the early years of JFK's life, and certainly in the early presidency. And we're going to come back for another episode about the kind of high points of his presidency, the Cuban Missile Crisis, civil rights, and how those things are being have been reevaluated and understood by historians. So thanks again to Professor Nash, and we'll talk to you next week.